Over the next half hour, we take you back to a time when living with HIV and AIDS was very different than it is today. We hear it through the eyes of two people who worked with those who had the virus. Jackie, a nurse from Tyneside, and Patrick, who was involved with AIDS North, one of the first groups helping those who are HIV positive, and one of the first employees of MESMAC in Newcastle.
I was going to say I felt it was a challenge. You know, it wasn't. I was just, I wanted to do something that was interesting and rewarding, and I just felt that I had the skills to take into that role, but I certainly never ever felt that they were a threat to me in any way, shape or form. You saw what was happening in the media, how people were stigmatised, isolated, living in fear. And that's what I saw. I didn't see that person or persons as a threat to me in any way, shape or form.
Yeah, it was really when I moved back to the Northeast and I met a group of people who just set up AIDS North, which is the first kind of education programme that was set up here in the Northeast. And some of those people were positive, HIV positive, and it was then, I think, something that became much more politicised for me, and it became something that I thought I really need to pay attention to this, because I was well aware that it wasn't anything that was in my kind of worldview before I kind of became a little bit more educated about it and I realised that it had implications. So I suppose that's the first time I actually felt this has got something to do with me and it's got something to do with the communities that I kind of mix with and that I'm friendly with and the people that I love are affected by this. So that's probably the first time I think it came into my consciousness as something that was tangible.
The National Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta today released the results of a study which shows that the lifestyle of some male homosexuals has triggered an epidemic of a rare form of cancer. Robert Bazell now...
I went into that profession to help people, regardless of what that person was going through. You know, someone did once say to me, "Not frightened that they bite you." And I was absolutely horrified. I said, "Why would someone bite me?" But that's the attitude that, you know, so imagine someone saying that to me. What's their perception and attitude towards someone who's positive? Absolutely horrendous.
It was varied, I've got to say. Some people responded to it very differently from other people. A lot of the people that I met, because I met them through AIDS North, had quite a good support system within their friendship group. What struck me very quickly is that a number of them were quite isolated from their families. They weren't feeling able to be open about their diagnosis with the family or with their work colleagues. A lot of people had to leave work. They felt like they couldn't kind of sustain a kind of a job. So I realised it was quite an isolating kind of illness, and that people relied very heavily on their friends and their kind of colleagues who were invested, I suppose, in supporting them.
The fear of AIDS has led the Football Association to ban communal baths and to advise against kissing on the pitch.
The fear of AIDS has made some churchgoers refuse to drink from the communion chalice.
The fear of AIDS has provoked attacks on perfectly well people, attacks which include us.
Do you know one of the best things about the job? Because in my profession, you don't really hug people, but you hugged people. And it was lovely. Because you'll have heard of, like, touch deprivation. It was that fear and, you know, just holding somebody's hand, but they would, you know, you would see them and you just give them a big hug. And they just, they would like soak it up, you know, because they might not have any human contact till the next time, you know. So, yeah, that was nice part of the job. I always, not just myself, but colleagues, we used to go out to places of work. Someone once rang me up and said, I disclosed my status to a colleague at work who then disclosed it to the manager. I went into work today and the manager called me into the office, and with her back to me as she was looking in a filing cabinet, said, I've been informed that you're HIV positive, and he was suspended for a week. We know that there was a lot of discrimination about HIV in the workplace, you know, that passing the virus on to other people, lack of education and knowledge. So I went with him because people are covered by Disability Discrimination Act. So myself and another colleague at the time who was more into like the employment law side of things, we provided a lot of support with him, helping him to how best to approach this. Went along with solicitor so that sister gave him sort of like guidance and encouragement as well. And we basically had to go along and do a lot of education work. And he was reinstated.
There is now a danger that has become a threat to us all. It is a deadly disease and there is no known cure. The virus can be passed during sexual intercourse with an infected person. Anyone can get it, man or woman. So far, it's been confined to small groups, but it's spreading. So protect yourself and read this leaflet when it arrives. If you ignore AIDS, it could be the death of you. So don't die of ignorance.
I think there was still an awful lot of fear and a lot of uncertainty and a lot of misinformation, I think, that was out there. And you know what the adverts were like that came out there. I think it was Norman Fowler who was kind of like the person responsible for introducing them, which is a big surprise for me in the first place. But they were quite scary adverts, but they didn't really impart a lot of specific information that was relevant to gay and bisexual men, and it didn't acknowledge, I don't think, the fact that there was a whole host of men who may not have identified as gay or bisexual but were having sex with other men. So I think it was very much, well, it was a conservative with a small c and a capital C campaign, wasn't it? And I think it was very much created a lot of fear in the community, and it created even more fear, I think, in the straight community, who then saw themselves as separate from gay and bisexual men.
Spinderella cut it up one time. Come on.
Let's talk about sex, baby.
I think a lot of people didn't want to hear it. I can remember very clearly one of the campaigns that we did on early World AIDS Day was outside of Phoenix when the Christmas window had just been unleashed on the world. So it was a huge queue of kind of like families and kind of children. And there was me and my two colleagues handing out information about safer sex and condoms and lube and kind of, you know, talking to people about why they needed to pay attention to safer sex. And we didn't get a vast amount, I've got to say, not as much kind of negative reaction as I thought. We had one or two people saying, we don't think you should be talking about that because there are kids here. And I think because we were kind of fairly down to earth, kind of receptive to talking to people. We weren't kind of like Anna with a banner out there, you know, and kind of, because the whole thing at that time was around, if you talked about sex, and particularly if you talked about gay sex, people were always accusing you, you know, you're pushing it down my throat.
Oh, yeah.
The thing that was most important for me was the high level of visibility, that this was normalised and that this is something you should be able to talk about. Because even, you know, my experience has been that even a lot of gay men find it difficult to talk about sex and about what they really want and what the drama is. Probably getting better now in the internet age, you know, when people have got access to lots of websites and information, all the rest, and some of it misinformation. And some of those kind of websites create I suppose, unrealistic expectations about what sex is going to be like. But it started a dialogue about kind of relationships can be different. You know, you can have, you know, different types of relationship, different kinds of sex, and even gay men didn't really talk about that quite as openly as they might have done. And I think they may have done lots of different things. And some people I know, when I went to, worked at MESMAC and provided, well, we were involved in the counselling service, is that people had felt pressured to have unsafe sex and hadn't felt able to say, actually, this is what I want you to do, but I don't want you to do that. I'm not interested in that kind of sex. I want this kind of sex. People just didn't have that education or that ability or the skill set to negotiate safe sex. So that was a big part of what we were doing.
There was one lad in particular, he was positive for a long, long time, and he was come at the end of his life, and he was on the ward for quite some time. And his family were very, very supportive. They knew the diagnosis, they were very, very supportive. I went out the ward one day, and the nurse and staff said, oh, he doesn't want any more visitors. He stopped his family coming. So I went to see him. I said, you know, what's happening here? I understand you don't want any visitors. And he said, I've got the doctors coming in. How are you feeling today? I've got the nurses coming in. How are you feeling today? I've got, you know, people coming in. How are you feeling today? I've got my family coming in. How are you feeling today? What have the doctors said? What's happening now? What... You know, just asking questions about health, which, let's face it, we all do it. So I was taking him off the ward, and we had a plan. We discussed it with the family. We got them all together with him, so that everybody had an understanding of how everybody was feeling. And then the plan was that once a week I would take him to a family member's home where they would all meet up and they would talk about how they felt knowing that he was going to die, and they would shed tears and they would hug, and then they would change the subject and they would have a laugh and they'd talk about whatever they wanted to talk about. And that went on right up until death. And when I'm talking about it now, you think, God, that's what it was like.
Well, for a start, we can tell you that no one has ever got the disease simply by being in the same room as an infected person, far less from living next door to one, from drinking from the same cup, or from simply sharing a bath or a shower. No one has got it from a kiss on the cheek. There's not a shred of evidence that you can get the disease by any of these means.
So it's about three people I knew who were HIV positive, one of whom did die when I was in AIDS North. And I've got to say, because at that time, some of the HIV specialists in Newcastle, where this person was being treated, had been properly engaged, I think, with AIDS North, they felt like their treatment was fairly positive. You know, even though the outcome wasn't a positive outcome, I suppose what they managed to do, and they were a very particular personality, and I won't name names, but they were incredibly attractive, very outgoing, who had that kind of very direct ability to say to people, this is what's happening to me, and this is how I feel about it, and the drugs that I'm taking are affecting me in this way. Is there anything we can do about that? So I felt like that there was a bit of a dialogue there. And in some ways, that gave me a little bit of hope for other people that they were engaged in their treatment, and they were engaged in talking about what they wanted out of their experience, you know what I mean? And a couple of the people I know who have died, they were very much proactive in saying, and also, this is what I want afterwards, this is what I want my legacy to be, this is how I want my funeral, but this is what I would like to see afterwards, that it's not a waste.
I once organised a wedding on the ward. It was a woman who had a partner. Anyway, she always said that she would never get married unless she knew the end was near. And this Oh, she was lovely. She used to always make us a Victoria sandwich when I used to go to visit. She used to always make a homemade Victoria sandwich cake when I used to go to visit her. She was lush. And she made the decision they were going to get married 2 weeks, in 2 weeks' time. And I thought, no, she's not going to be here in 2 weeks' time. So I rang the registrar and I said, could you do it this afternoon by any chance? And it was all a rush job. It was a case of get home and get your suit on. I managed to bring it forward. And then she passed away the next day. But it's doing things like that. It's sad, but it's lovely as well. It's lovely to think that you can do that for somebody. Some people didn't want to take medication because they just didn't like to take medication. Some people, you know, who don't want to take paracetamol if they've got a headache. Some people who had taken medication when we had AZT and, you know, and the side effects of that, where there would be nausea, diarrhoea, where you would be walking on the street and just no control whatsoever. The uneven distribution of fat in the face and in the body, the weight loss, people would have like thin legs and or maybe fat elsewhere in their body, which they would feel identified them as being positive. But the I would say the nausea in the vomiting, diarrhea, skin rash, some people would have a skin reaction to the medication, would probably be enough for them to say, I cannot tolerate this, would be impacting too much on their quality of life. So they would choose a quality of life rather than a quantity of life. And that's where it would be difficult working with somebody who does make that choice. And it could be quite frustrating because you'd want that person to stay well and live a longer life expectancy. And it would be frustrating, but you had to respect what that person's decision was.
I think for a lot of people, they saw that as a kind of a real hope, you know, that kind of it wasn't a something that would just result in kind of getting worse and worse and then dying at the end. And all of the films that were out around that time, that's kind of what they showed and that's what they demonstrate, you know, Kaposi sarcoma and kind of all kinds of things that people would, you know, BNP pneumonia and kind of people getting seriously ill. And I think the AZT, what it did is it started to create a little bit of hope in the community that drug regimes could actually help. And it demonstrated, I suppose, that maybe the government were taking a little bit more seriously the need to address this and put some research into how it happened.
Just by being there, for a lot of people, it was just enough. Being there at someone's bedside when you know that they're going to pass away. Being with a mother, and I remember one just chatting with her, and my son was very, very poorly, and one of the nurses had rang me, and obviously, I mean, the nursing staff are just second to none. They were amazing. But, you know, they could ring and say, oh, you know, so-and-so's about to pass away. You know, Mum's there, can you come down? So you'd go and you'd sit with Mum, and she'd be chatting away, and then you would become used to seeing the signs, the breathing change and what have you. And I remember one day sitting and I just said, you know, it's time. And she was there when he breathed his last. And then you just console that person just being there. And the fact that they know that you know, because, you know, someone who's lost someone to the virus, they are then carrying that secret. And a lot of times, you know, like if you had a younger person who was very, very poorly, you were keeping that secret with them. So, you know, people would say, oh, well, what's the matter with them? you know, so what more have they died of? And they were having to tell lies or keeping the secret. And to imagine how that must feel. Absolutely horrendous.
Think about kind of, you know, almost it was, you know, if you're having sex that's unprotected with people and you don't know your status, you know, you might infect them, and it's kind of then, you know, the whole dialogue was around kind of anybody who's HIV positive got it, they're going to die. That was the only dialogue in town, you know what I mean? It was going to truncate your life, you were going to have a really difficult time and blah, blah, blah. So to go to a GUM clinic or and there was issues around insurance as well. So, you know, a lot of people did not want to go to their GPs. They didn't want to kind of compromise any kind of life insurance or kind of travel insurance. And there were a lot of myths around that as well. But there were actually some factual kind of things, and people did ask those questions, and employers asked those questions. Have you been tested? Now, for anybody, all of the messages were coming out were about, you know, you're being responsible if you do get tested and you know your status and you can protect yourself and all the rest of it. But that's not how insurance and kind of other places reacted to that. It was, if you've been tested, you put yourself at risk. Therefore, you're a risky person and we are going to increase you. You know, you have to pay more for your insurance, etc., or we won't insure you. So I think it's that few things really. One is, you're going to have to sit in front of somebody you probably haven't met before, who's usually a heterosexual woman, and tell them about the kind of sex that you've had and how frequently you had it. And I think it's a little bit at that time, it was a little bit about, you know, when people ask you if you smoke, how many you smoke, and people say, oh, I have about five a day, whereas actually they're going through five packets. Because of that kind of, I'm telling you as a medical professional what I think you want to hear, I'll kind of dumb it down a bit because it doesn't make me seem as bad. So I think that's kind of, that happened a little bit. There was a little bit of shame.
I had a positive woman who had a child. Child went to nursery school. I got a phone call to say that the health visitor had disclosed mum's diagnosis to the nursery. The nursery had fears about the child bumping heads with another child in the playground. What they're going to do? So myself and the paediatric specialist nurse went out to the nursery, met with all the staff, who obviously then knew about mum's diagnosis, which should never have happened in the first place. Again, it's a lack of knowledge and how to manage it. So we had to go out and say, where's the risk? I mean, obviously, if two people clashed and there was two open wounds, and well, that fair dues, but this wasn't going to happen. One, they should never have been made aware of mum's diagnosis. And two, you had a negative child. So where was the transmission risk?
From my perspective, it feels much more like an open dialogue now, and it's much more acceptable to say you're HIV positive, and people don't have that instant reaction of kind of backing off and thinking, all right, well, thank you very much, it was nice knowing you, and I'll see you around, but maybe, you know, they'll just drift away a little bit. And I think that was certainly the case at the beginning when people disclosed their HIV status. And of course, not everybody knows their HIV status, so, you know, one of the things we used to drum into people is, if you don't know, you don't know, you know, and it's kind of, you can't make assumptions. And if you do know, you generally, in some ways, if you're more honest and open. There's a big dialogue, isn't there, about kind of how if you're HIV positive, you really should tell people that you're HIV positive. And I'm not a big believer in that because I think, well, you know, you need to be responsible for yourself. And that might not go down too well in some quarters, but I do think that's the case. Because it isn't easy even now, I don't think, to disclose that you've got HIV. I don't think. And I think some people still carry some of those myths about HIV. And I think because we don't talk about it now in the way that we used to, it's just not as kind of, you know, it's not on EastEnders anymore and it's not on Emmerdale or kind of wherever, then there isn't really a dialogue about it. It's kind of almost like, oh, well, we move beyond that now because people have got treatment for it, so we don't need to talk about it. But I think the instant somebody declares they're HIV positive, I still think there's a reaction to it that isn't the same as if somebody had said they've got some other kind of illness.
The improvements in the drugs where the virus is no longer transmittable if the virus is undetectable. I never thought in a million years you'd say that. And I suppose anybody who's living with the virus would never have imagined that either. And it was a bit of a hard thing to get your head around and a little bit of a scary thing as well. People would still be alive if the medication that's available now was available back then. But obviously, it's been trial and error, hasn't it? Because, you know, one, what is this virus? How are we going to manage this virus? How are we going to treat these people? And it's been a lot of dedication from, obviously, the drug companies and the expertise of other people who actually sort of, like, manage the treatment of HIV and the medication.
There's no chance for us.
I know when I went to see Bohemian Rhapsody, at the end of that film, I couldn't get out of my seat because it was this overall grief reaction I felt at the end of that film. And I had to sit and I had to compose myself because all I could see was a sea of faces of people who'd passed away. And it was, yeah, overwhelming. You cope by, I suppose, you've got this, like, shield up. You've worked very closely with that person. You've become very, very close to them. They trust you. They can tell you anything. You know, that's a great privilege to have that level of trust from someone. And then they pass away. It is absolutely heartbreaking. You never forget them, but there's always somebody else that you're caring for.
When the drugs didn't work on Pride Radio.